Walt Whitman. I was going to say a neat guy, but it just occurred to me that's a kind of a droll thing to say about a great poet. He's a neat guy. But I guess he would have liked to have heard that. He was a neat guy. Interesting guy. Walt Whitman, I told some of you were here, maybe, yeah, because some of the same customers. I just was going on about how Robert Frost was the greatest poet America ever produced on Monday or whatever it was. And then Tuesday we got to Emily Dickinson, and I said, Emily Dickinson is far away the greatest poet. Guess who today? Walt Whitman is, I don't know who's to say who's the greatest and all that, but certainly Frost, Dickinson, and Whitman are the three greatest poets America has produced, in my opinion, and a lot of others, I suppose. Song of Myself, which we're going to talk about today, is obviously the greatest American poem we've been produced yet. It's a long sucker. It's about 54 pages long. We're not going to do it all. We're going to do some sections, but it's a great thing. I talked a little bit about Longfellow, mentioned him in passing the other day, and how he was structured with rhythm and iambic pentameter and all that stuff. By the shore, a Gitche Gumee dwelt the wigwam of Nokomis, bum, bum, bum. You can't get lost in that rhythm. The first poem I ever read, I remember reading in my life in the seventh grade, was This is the Forest Primeval, a home of the murmuring hemlocks and pines or whatever that was. Yes, you read that. Yeah, and I loved it. I loved that line, and I didn't know what a primeval forest was. Still not sure I'd recognize one, but that was my introduction to poetry in the seventh grade. And as I mentioned in Poetry Reading and that, I spent the next two or three years fighting my arch enemy, William Craig Miles, across the aisle, who thought I was some sort of a sap for liking poetry. So William and I battled for 3 years until he finally broke his arm in the eighth grade. Set his hash. We didn't mean to. But anyway, Walt Whitman is a different breed of poet. If Longfellow was very stable and his lines were, let us then be up and doing, learn to labor and to wait, very stoic, dignified, sonorous tones like an organ. And that was American poetry. Whitman came along and just blew it right out of the water. No rhythm, at least it's not very discernible. No rhyme, it's free verse. He talks about, if Longfellow talked about learning to labor and to wait, Whitman talks about the smell of my armpits is aroma finer than prayer. And people were saying, wait a minute. I want to hear about your pits, Walt. Let's go, what happened to Longfellow? And, but Whitman was not that kind of a poet. He didn't have that to say, or he wanted to say it differently. And very often he would say, my soul is no less than my body. My body should not abase itself to my soul. And where we go together. And he was a great one for body and soul. Kind of before that, we were in the tradition of the body is okay, but you know how it is. If you really want to be good, you somehow deny the flesh and kind of a St. Paul attitude and release the spirit. Well, Whitman didn't like that. He says, nuts to that. Where I go, my body goes too. He says, I've got a great, my body is so good and it's all so luscious. And people said, oh, come on. They were throwing his book away as fast as he could run it off in his own little ditto machine or whatever he had. They would take a look at it and drop it in the trash can because they weren't interested in his armpits or his luscious body. And first of all, his song is Song of Myself. Well, that's kind of a arrogant thing. The Longfellow's talking about let us then be up and doing and learning to labor and to wait, and it's right out of Jonathan Edwards' Puritan tradition, the work ethic and all that kind of thing. And here he says, the first line is, I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I shall assume, you shall assume. For what belongs to me as good belongs to you. He's all the brothers ever lived, all the men ever lived are my brothers, and the women are my sisters and lovers. He says, another place he says, it is no better to be a man than a woman, or vice versa. The whole fusion theme runs through Walt Whitman, the idea of dark, light, man, woman, love, death, sex, whatever. It's all one. It's Eastern in that regard, or at least maybe this is where East and West meet in Walt Whitman a little bit. So he's new, he was radical, couldn't hold a job or didn't. I think he would have loved Holden if he could have been here. There's a great scene from when Walt was walking down the street. He lived in New York, He was an editor, fine journalist. Whitman's a long tradition of writers who are journalists. I used to teach journalism for 7 years at the college where I teach, and I finally gave it up. It became so hectic. But I used to get, and I also teach creative writing, and I used to get students who would not feel they could do both. They say, hey, I'm a poet. I can't write for the newspaper. And that kind of ignorance is just blessed, I guess. They just have any idea how many writers have been journalists, like Hemingway and Whitman and you name it. Nothing will sharpen your prose better than writing for a newspaper. You just think you've got all kinds of great lines until an editor says, yes, but can you give it to me this big? I say, yes, but this, I want it this big. I say, oh. It takes a skill. Anyway, he was walking down the beach there on Long Island one day with his father, and it's a scene right out of maybe lots of households. You can see Walt, 40-plus years old, walking down the beach, and his father, his arm around him, his father says, Walt, get a job. And Walt says, Dad, I've had him. And he couldn't hold him very well, but he was an editor for a long time, and he did do that very, very well. He was a good editor. He was active in editing in the newspaper. He owned a couple of newspapers. He edited newspapers. He was active in politics, in Democratic politics, in New York City. Did a lot of things. And he wrote a lot of poetry that wasn't all that good. It was mediocre. Some of it gained notoriety. O Captain, My Captain, Our Fearful Trip Is Done, Our Ship Has Weathered Every Storm, or something, something, something. That was, and that's a nice poem. It's about the ship of state. It's about Lincoln and the birth of the nation and all that. But it was, O Captain, My Captain, Our Fearful Trip Is Done. It was iambic tetrameter or whatever. It was still in the Longfellow tradition. He hadn't broken into his own thing yet. And then all of a sudden, he's about 37 years old, and for some reason, which luckily scholars haven't been able to figure out, you know, they're not happy unless they've got everything figured out. They don't know exactly why. They got a few ideas. He started writing a different thing. Instead of, O Captain, My Captain, Our Fearful Trip Is Done, he says, I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a sphere of summer grass. That's another thing that turned people off. He's always leaning and loafing and looking at the grass. And they said, have you no gumption? Well, he had gumption. He worked very hard. He liked to loaf. He said, what's wrong with lying down in the grass once in a while? Grass became a symbol for Whitman, for everything that was America. Pulsating rebirth, every spring the new grass shoots coming forth and all that. So he called his book Leaves of Grass. And he only wrote one book. He had about 8 or 9 editions, but he just kept opening the covers and stuffing in new poems, and it grew and grew and grew. But it's always called Leaves of Grass. And the biggest poem is Song of Myself. Just to give you an idea of what we're talking about here, he was born in 1819 and died in 1892. And it's free verse. I wish I could show you. You can't see this, but probably, but it just goes all over the page. One line may be an inch long, and the next one may go over the whole page. He stopped when he came to the end of it. A lot of times my students, sometimes they get frustrated with free verse. How do I know when to stop? I said, well, when you feel like stopping. And well, I don't know when I feel like it. And I said, then don't stop. That's crummy advice for a professor, but I don't know what else to tell him. You finally learn to write, work with free verse, and you just go by gut feeling, I guess. So Whitman is on the edge of the frontier. The Frederick Jackson Turner, whatever his name was, thesis, you know, the expanding frontier, go west, young man, all that was going on. It was America was flexing its muscles, and we're looking west and trying new things, always on the periphery. And Whitman was right there with his poetry. So we have a man at the right time saying the right thing. And when that happens, you usually have kind of a cataclysmic thing in art. There's very often you get a person who's ready and the time isn't, or the time was and he wasn't there yet, whatever. But now we have Walt Whitman coming after Longfellow, and America's expanding and Whitman's expanding and his horizons. And it was an explosion, and the likes of which you don't see all that often in art. Okay, and he was saying things that we have proven now by astronomy and radar and the microscope and all kinds of things. When he says every atom of what is that line? Every atom belonging to me is good belongs to you. That's true. Later on, in another part of this poem I'll get to, he says something, the leaf, I'll get to it. I might as well just quit talking about this and jump right into it, okay? I'll put on my glasses here so I can see whether I'm reading Robert Frost or Whitman. It is Whitman. Okay, I'm going to open with these a few lines again just to set the stage. I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume you shall assume. Now that, remember, that angered people too. They didn't like him telling them, what I assume you shall, what if I don't want to assume that? All right, then don't assume. For every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. My tongue, every atom of my blood formed from this soil, this air, born here of parents, born here from parents the same and their parents the same. I now, 37 years old in perfect health, begin. And all of a sudden at 37, then he's saying a new thing. Free verse is born. And we don't know why, what happened exactly. Song of Myself is a very long poem, and I'm just going to pick out some parts and going to talk about them. Section 5 begins, I believe in you, my soul, the other I am, which is his body, must not abase itself to you, and you must not be abased to the other. He always wanted his body and soul to be thought of as one. This whole poem, one way to look at this poem is a mystical journey. When you read the whole thing, you'll notice that the sections, he kind of goes into himself, into his psyche, starts exploring his inner being, whatever that is. And the deeper he goes, the more he gets into himself, until finally he gets some very somber lines. And he gets back to the crucifixion. He says, I suffered all the agonies. I'm the runaway slave. They nailed me to the cross. He becomes every man. He takes on the agonies of the world. He says, I suffered. I was the man. I was there. And he gets to the point where in this inward journey, it gets very scary. And if you start sailing those seas between your ears too much without some friends around or some help, you know, you can get lost down there. And he finally comes back out of it. And at the end of the poem, he's back with us again, and after writing 52 pages, he's had this mystical experience, then we expect him to tell us, what are the answers? And as you might guess, he doesn't have any. His answer, he says, I'm going to put my arm around your waist, old buddy, and I'll walk up to the nearest hill with you, and I'll check to make sure you got good hiking boots on and a staff, and I'll point down the road, and maybe give you a little shove. That's his answer. And we wade through 54 pages and we said, that's it? Well, it's not too unreasonable, is it? Whether it's Buddha with a vision or Christ with a vision or whoever. One person's vision becomes very difficult, if not impossible, to translate. It would be so much nicer, I suppose, so much tidier for religions if we could just look at one person's vision and then the whole world could agree on what that means. But things don't seem to work out that way. Crazy Horse is another person who had, if you've read anything, had a vision, too. That's where he got his name, Crazy Horse. Anyway, I believe in you, my soul. The other I am must not abase it to you. Section 5 is a very interesting section. I think I'll just read it, 5 or 6 lines, and then just maybe say a word. Loaf with me on the grass, loose the stop from your throat. Not words, not music or rhyme I want, not custom or lecture, not even the best. Only the lull I like, the hum of your velvet voice. I mind how once we lay such a transparent summer morning, how you settled your head athwart my hips and gently turned over upon me, and parted the shirt from my bosom bone and plunged your tongue to my bare stripped heart, and reached till you felt my beard and reached till you held my feet, swiftly arose and spread around me the peace and knowledge that pass all the argument of the earth. And I know that the hand of God is the promise of my own, and I know that the spirit of God is the brother of my own, and that all the men ever born are also my brothers, and the women my sisters and lovers. Now that is really new in literature. This is a sexual experience of some kind. And through the sexual experience, he begins the mystical experience. Now, if you're really going to be traditional and have a mystical experience, you flagellate the flesh, you deny the flesh, you lie on a bed of nails or walk on coals, you do something, right, to lift your spirit out. Whitman goes into his mystical experience right through sex. And a lot of people took one look at that. If the smell of his armpits didn't do it, this did, and they threw it away. I suppose if you're looking for a reason to throw a book away, and I just read an article last night from Saturday Review or Time or something, I've forgotten, that book censorship and book banning is back with us, and how many communities around the United States are burning this. Kurt Vonnegut is on the list now, and they're burning him. And why? I can't imagine. I think he's about as innocuous a writer as I've read in a long time. But it's certainly not worth burning. He's good, but, well, I don't want to get into that. But it's a bad thing to burn a book, it seems to me. What he learns through the sexual experience, interesting. Immediately, he says, how you settled your head athwart my hips, gently turned over upon me, parted the shirt from my bosom bone, plunged your tongue to my bare-stripped heart, and reached you, felt my beard, and reached you, held my feet, swiftly arose and spread around me the peace and knowledge that passed all the argument of the earth, and I know that the hand of God is the promise of my own, and I know that the Spirit of God is the brother of my own, and that all the men ever born are also my brothers, and the women my sisters and lovers. Not too far from the New Testament, is it? D.H. Lawrence, a great English poet, had the same kind of reaction, that sex, in fact, D.H. Lawrence took Whitman one step further and said the sex act is the highest form of communication to God. That doesn't wash with just everybody, and I wouldn't, so what, nothing washes with everybody. But Whitman echoes that. Section 6 starts out with, a child said, what is the grass? Fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition out of hopeful green stuff woven, or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrancer designedly dropped, bearing the owner's name some way in the corners that we may see and remark and say, whose? And he goes on for maybe 20 or 30 lines about grass. Another thing he does when he writes this poem, he becomes very childlike. And when the child says, what is this grass? He says, how do I don't know. Very, very childlike. We've all had that feeling once in a while, especially in a place like Holden, don't you think? You see the water, and you become so moved by the glaciers or the rocks or the trees, you almost as if you had never been there. And you wonder, what is this stuff? How did this mountains get here? If you don't have that sense of awe and wonder, then something wrong somewhere, I think. But Wordsworth had that sense too. Once he was in a little boat dinghy on one of the lakes in northern England, and it became dark, and there's a famous account of how the shadows of this big bluff seemed to reach out over the lake, and he was rowing under the shadow of this bluff, and he really became frightened, and he docked his boat and ran up and grabbed a tree and just hung on. He almost almost embraced the tree. He didn't know what a tree was. It was just so new all of a sudden. Those epiphanic moments are rare, but they do happen. Wordsworth, another great, I'm not talking about Wordsworth today, but Jim Gann, are you listening, Jim? He always accuses me of digressing, but I don't. He just forgets what I'm talking about. Now I forgot the digression. Yeah, about Wordsworth. I forgot. It's well forgotten. Joe Sittler, great theologian from Chicago, was at our school one time giving an address, and he said, I've got 5 salient points. And he got to the fourth one, and he kind of looked at me and said, I forgot 5. He says, it's well forgotten. Well, if Joe can do it, I can. Stanza 7, he starts out, has anyone supposed it lucky to be born? I know what I was going to say about Wordsworth. Go back. Wordsworth said in his great poem, Ode on Intimations of Immortality, he said, children come from heaven trailing clouds of glory as they come. Great line. According to Wordsworth, just giving off a little glitter. You know, they're just an aura about them. And the poem, what he's saying there in that part is that the older we get, the less clouds of glory we exhibit until layer upon layer of of the world is put upon us, and we are less responsive, we're less intuitive, we're less whatever. And until finally we act very nice and neat and according to all kinds of nice plans. And it's the children who just kind of give off the glitter. You ever notice little kiddos when they're, I don't know, 1.5 or 2, and they hear music, how they just kind of bounce up and down? And we would like to, but we more or less kind of just listen, maybe tap a toe inside our shoe, little babies bounce up and down. They're still trailing those clouds of glory. Has anyone supposed it lucky to be born? I hasten to inform him or her, it is just as lucky to die, and I know it. I pass death with the dying and birth with a new-washed babe, and am not contained between my hat and boots, and pursue manifold objects, no two alike, and everyone good, the earth good, and the stars good, and their adjuncts all good. I am not an earth, nor an adjunct of an earth. I am the mate and companion of people, all just as immortal and fathomless as myself. They do not know how immortal, but I know. Every kind for itself and its own, for me, mine, male and female, for me, those that have been boys and those that love women, for me, the man that is proud and feels how it stings to be slighted, for me, the sweetheart and the old maid, for me, mothers and the mothers of mothers, for me, lips that have smiled, eyes that have shed tears, for me, children and the begetters of children, and on and on. This is called the Whitman Catalog. Once he gets a full head of steam, he'll go on like this for sometimes pages, and it's called, we just call it cataloging because it's like reading a certain book about catalog. He starts to embrace everything, and he just gets up a full head of steam. It's right out of the Old Testament. It reads like some of the Old Testament writers. It also reads like Moby Dick. Some of the passages in Melville are like a huge cascading wave bearing down on it. It's like a locomotive run away. And you have to be selective with Whitman. You can read some stirring passages, and all of a sudden he gets the bit in his mouth, and then you'll never get him back. And he goes on for pages like that. And if you like that kind of thing, then Whitman is for you. And if it gets too tedious, then probably Robert Frost might be the better. Here's section 11. This is kind of change of pace for him. 28 young men bathed by the shore. 28 young men and all so friendly. 28 years of womanly life and all so lonesome. She owns the fine house by the rise of the bank. She hides handsome and richly dressed after the blinds of the window. Which of the young men does she like the best? Ah, the homeliest of them is beautiful to her. Where are you off to, lady, for I see you? You splash in the water there, yet stay stock still in your room. Dancing and laughing along the beach came the 29th bather. The rest did not see her, but she saw them and loved them. The beards of the young men glistened with wet. It ran from their long hair. Little streams passed all over their bodies. An unseen hand also passed over their bodies. It descended tremblingly from their temples and ribs. The young men float on their backs, their white bellies bulged to the sun. They do not ask who seizes fast to them. They do not know who puffs and declines with pendant and bending arch. They do not think whom they souse with spray. Follow that immediately by section 12, which begins, the butcher boy puts off his killing clothes or sharpens his knife at the stall in the market. Another thing Whitman did was go from one subject to the other. He just had a very tender, gentle, compassionate stanza about the lonely woman watching these 28 guys in the sea. And then the next line is the butcher boy puts off his killing clothes and got blood and all over the place. He does that. The juxtaposition of unlike elements is another thing that Whitman did. Longfellow would never have conceived of doing that. You talk about one thing and then you have some sort of a transition and you go to something else. Whitman felt that life wasn't like that. Life is too fast. And so why not put those things together? If it jars, then it jars. But life often jars. Mostly jars, seems to me. Whitman, for being a great poet, has said so much in this, all these poems that he is capable of saying things that are kind of funny. Section 14, he's got a line, says, the wild gander leads his flock through the cool night. You honk, he says. You honk. I first read that and I thought, you honk? What kind of a poet is that? You honk. That's what it says. How else would you describe what the wild gander says? It sounds like a you honk, so he put it in. See, another thing Longfellow wouldn't have done. Longfellow or Keats or maybe even Shakespeare would have found some other nicer, euphonious way to say it, or they wouldn't have said it, but not Walt. Do you honk? I like that. The sharp-hoofed moose of the north, the cat on the house sill, the chickadee, the prairie dog, the litter of the grunting sow, the brood of the turkey hen, and she with her half-spread wings, I see in them and myself the same old law. Everything he sees, he's at one with. I'll just give you here's an idea of this section. This section 15 goes on, just to give you an idea of the catalog. I'll read this just without any break, just to give you an idea. The pure contralto sings in the organ loft. The carpenter dresses his plank. The tongue of his foreplane whistles its wild ascending lisp. The married and unmarried children ride home to the Thanksgiving dinner. The pilot seizes the kingpin. He heaves down with a strong arm. The mate stands braced in the whaleboat. The duck shooter walks by silent and cautious stretches. The deacons are ordained and with crossed hands at the altar. The spinning girl retreats and advances to the hum of the big wheel. The farmer stops by the bars as he walks on a first day loaf and looks at the oats and rye. The lunatic is carried at last to the asylum, a confirmed case. He will never sleep anymore, as he did in the cot in his mother's bedroom. The juror painter, printer, with gray head and gaunt jaws, works at his case. He turns his quid of tobacco while his eyes blur with the manuscript. And on, see, everything is subject for his poetry. Every possible job and possible people. Talks about the Kentuckian, the Oregonian, the Californian, the Washingtonian, the canal boy, the conductor, the child, the regret, the drover, the peddler sweats with his pack on his back. The bride unrumples her white dress. The minute hand of the clock moves slowly. The opium eater reclines with rigid head and just open lips. The prostitute draggles her shawl. Her bonnet bobs on her tipsy and pimpled neck. The crowd laugh at her blackguard oaths. The men jeer and wink to each other. Miserable, I do not laugh at your oaths nor jeer you. The president holding a cabinet council surrounded by the great secretaries. Here's a great juxtaposition. But that's Walt Whitman. Part of his work is called a section called Democratic Vistas. He thought of himself as the poet of democracy, as the poet of America. That everyone is equal. And equality meant a great deal to him. I am the poet of the body, and I am the poet of the soul. The pleasures of heaven are with me, and the pains of hell are with me. The first I graft and increase upon myself, the latter I translate into a new tongue. I am the poet of the woman, the same as the man, and I say it is as great to be a woman as to be a man. And I say there's nothing greater than the mother of men. He says, Walt Whitman, a cosmos of Manhattan, the sun, turbulent, fleshy, sensual, eating, drinking, and breeding. No sentimentalist, no stander above men and women or apart from them. No more modest than immodest. Unscrew the locks and the doors. Unscrew the doors themselves and their jams. Whoever degrades another degrades me. And whatever is done or said returns at last to me. I speak the password primeval. I give the sign of democracy. By God, I will accept nothing which all cannot have their counterpart of on the same terms. And somewhere in here he says, the smell of my armpits is aroma sweeter than prayer. Here's a good line. I dote on myself. There is that lot of me and all so luscious. And people threw that one away. One man, luckily for us, didn't throw it away. And he just happened to be the greatest mind of the time and one of the greatest of all times, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson, of course, didn't write this kind of stuff. Emerson would not talk about his armpits. Emerson was just on a different space, but he recognized talent. And he picked this book up, and he was reading about Walt's armpits and all and on and on. He said, he wrote a nice letter to Whitman and said, there's much to be admired in here, and then blah, blah, blah. I greet you on the threshold of a brilliant career. Boy, Whitman saw that letter, and he took it back to his publisher, who was hoping Whitman wouldn't return with this stuff because nobody wanted it. He says, see what Emerson said? See? Run off another 2,000 copies, and we'll write on the cover, I greet you on the threshold of a brilliant career, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And now people pick it up and say, oh, Emerson likes it. Where's my copy? Where did I put that? See? It's the Emperor's New Clothes theory of art all over again. If Ralph Waldo Emerson liked it, that's probably not so bad. I say if you don't like something, don't like it. If Emerson says it's good, you don't, still shouldn't like it. But we're all alike now, I guess.
don't look around and count all the noses before you make up your own mind.
Yes.
Okay, here's a really nice, my favorite question, question 31. I believe, at least, this is the line I was talking about a while ago, when Whitman intuitively knew things, and he said things that we are now proving with telescopes and medicine and the whole thing. I believe a leaf of grass is no less than the generator of the stars. Now, if you'd only written that line only, it'd be a brilliant line. If you saw someone's cross-legged cosmos on CBS, that's the first thing I thought of when I saw that. And that was a brilliant thing. I thought Sagan's work was good, and he's written, I believe a leaf of grass is no less than the generator of the stars. Some of you are familiar with that little short movie, it was kind of how it's done. It's about a 10-minute film that I ended up being holding one time. It shows camera going up and you see the kind of galaxy in the cosmos spinning, and then it comes down into the back of the hand or the eye or something, and you get into the bloodstream, you see the same molecular structure, and you get the affinity. And the quagmire is equally perfect, and a grain of sand on the edge of the rim. And the tree toad is a tribute to the highest. And a running blackberry would adorn the parlors of heaven. That's one of my favorite lines of any religion. A running blackberry would adorn the parlors of heaven. And the narrowest hinge in my hand hits the storm all machines. And a cow crunching its depressed head surpasses any statue. And a mouse is miracle enough to stagger septillions of infidels. Now there's a... I want to hear that again. Those lines are worth doing. I believe the leaf of grass is no less than the journey worth of the stars, and the quagmire is equally perfect, and a grain of sand on the edge of the rim, and the tree toad is a tribute to the highest, and the black bear will adorn the colors of heaven, and the narrow hinge in my hand will put the storm all machines, and the cow, something that is best for us to pass to any statue. And a mouse is miracle enough to stagger septillions of infidels. Then in section 42, he says, I think I could turn and live with animals. They are so faster than a horse can train. Isn't that the truth? How often have you seen a cat lying on a dog or a cow in it, and you just kind of marvel at those. They're just doing their calmness or catness or whatever. And it just seems, every night I want to move my cat. It's just, cat for air, but anyway, he said, after that, I'm looking at it. I think I could turn and live with animals that are so fast and self-contained. I stand and look at them long and long. And the editor looks at that, he's been a little runner down to Whitman's house, but I think he made a mistake. He didn't mean a long time. He said, no, he said, I went long and long. And he said, well, that's not so what do you mean long and long? He said, that's how I feel. I stand and look at them long and long. The editor shook his head and went back to me. Of course, the same editor took his head at Robbie Burns in 19th century. And Scotland, which is my love of like a red rose. And it's just, Jerry Red Rose.
Okay.
No, Red Rose. Okay. I stand and look at them long and long. They do not sweat and whine about their condition. They do not lie awake in the dark and weep for their sin. They do not make me sick for suffering their duty to God. Not one is dissatisfied, not one is demented with the mania of owning things. Not one kneels to another, nor to his kind, that was thousands of years ago. Not one is respectable or unhappy over the whole earth. Now that's a lot about animals, isn't it? I'll read that again. Whitman, every occasion of digging out the velvet needle and kind of stir up people, stir up society, or make you think about them. He's not sarcastic or plastic. This is about as heavy as one of the suggestions of Mr. Jay. I think I could turn and live with animals. They are so plastic and self-contained. I stand and look at them long and long. They do not sweat and whine about their condition. They do not lie awake in the dark and weep for their sins. They do not make me sick to trust in their duty to God. Not one is dissatisfied. Not one is demented with a mania of anything. Not one kneels to another nor to his kind of the thousands of years ago. Not one is respectable or unhappy over the whole world. Chapter 35 seems like he's going to give us some answer now. He's going to explain his statement. The space and time, now I see it is true, what I guessed at. And I was kind of edging on the edge of my seat. But what is it, you think? What I guessed when I loafed on the grass. What I guessed when I lay alone in my bed. And again as I watched the beach and the pale stars of the morning, My thighs and ballast leave me, my elbows rest in two gaps. I skirt Sierra as my palms cover continents. I am afoot with my vision. And what is his vision? He forgets to tell it. He goes off on another catalog. This time it goes on to 7 pages. But there's some great lines there. I skirt Sierra, my elbows rest in two gaps. They're great lines. I skirt Sierra as my palms cover continents. I am afoot with my vision. Beautiful. Listen to this. He's prospecting, gold digging, girdling the trees of a new purpose, scorched ankle deep by the hot sand, hauling my boat down the shallow river where the panther walks to and fro on a limb overhead, where the buck turns fearful at the hunter, where the rattlesnake spends his flabby length on a rock, where the otter is feeding on fish, where the alligator in his cleft temple sleeps by the bayou, where the black bear is searching for roots for a hunter, where the beaver packs the mud with his paddle third tail. Over the ground, and on he goes, and he doesn't tell us if you're after him. But he's so caught up in seeing things in his mind that he just, and that's fine. He actually, we're better off. If he stops, can you imagine how dull it would be if he said, we have a 50-page essay on how he is? I'd rather hear from some poet who's got a keen eye, and we'll decide ourselves if what that's going to mean, or ignore it if they want to. And I think that's what life should be about. I don't think it's good to say. I just happened to think it in Florence when I walked into the after Rick Cameron, some of you know Rick Cameron from Holden. And Rick and I led a tour of most of Holden people in 1977 to Europe for 40 days. And had a lot of lifestyle people and some people, other people. And we were talking about art and what lessons it is. There were a lot of people that came to know what it meant. And we had a hard time getting relaxed, but well, I don't know what it means. Just kind of enjoyed it and look at it. And then we took them into the academia and we walked into the room about this size and nibble on their favorites and it was fun. And so there was the first time when we did kind of look at that and get upset. They never asked again what it means. You look at nibble on their favorites, you don't ask what it means. It's the greatest art, or St. Peter's before, but what does that mean? You don't think you asked that anymore. Then we took him to, went back again a couple of years ago, and I found a little ice cream place. Anybody going to Florence, please? Get a Zivoli's ice cream. I just tell him what I'm doing after that. It's the best ice cream in the world. It's in a back alley off some piazza over there, and it's unleaded, there's no name, there's no title, you just stumble on it, and it's great ice cream. Well, when you eat an ice cream, you don't go, what does that mean? They just have a real nice salmon dinner with great Canadian wine. You don't say, what is it? But sometimes people are insisting on what art is for to sell them something that they don't understand. And it does, I mean. I'm going to fix it. Section 38. Enough. Somehow I've been stunned. Stand up. Now we're going to get the answer time. Give me a little time, beyond my cuffed head, slumber, dreams gaping, I discover myself on the verge of a usual mistake. That I can forget the mockers and insults, that I can forget the trickling tears and blows of the bludgeons and hammers, that I can look with a separate look on my own crucifixion and bloody cannon. I remember now. I resume the overstage fraction, the grave of rock megaplies that has been confided to it, or any grave, corpses rise, gasses heal, fashions roll for me. I troop forth replenished with supreme power, one of an average unending profession, inland and too close to go, and pass all boundary lines, our swift ordinances on their way over the whole earth, the blossoms we wear in our hats, the growth of thousands of years. I salute you, come forward, continue your annotations, continue your questions. He ends up with, continue your questions. He starts by saying, I'm going to tell you the answer, and you wind up and say, keep asking. It's like Gertrude Stein, that great scene of Gertrude Stein when she was dying, and Gertrude Stein, as you know, is very intelligent woman, a friend of the left bank, all the other coming away and took care of, and she was the patron saint of all the last generation of terrorists, and the confidant and secretary, Alex B. Pickett, leaned over her bed, and Gertrude was doing her last. You know what Gertrude said? I'm bad. The same kind of thing we find in Melville's Billy Budge, great novella, where Billy Budge is quite figure. So everybody loves Billy. You know the story of Billy Budge, handsome girl guy who worked in the four company, was in the sales, and down below deck from the gun deck was the cottage, mean side of that. And he hated Billy for no good reason that we know it. Billy, everybody loved Billy. And Billy had one flaw, and tragic for the same body standard when he became very upset. And tried to accuse, maybe a guy did, and hope he didn't do some of this. Anyway, he accused Billy Budd of mutiny and brought him before Captain Deere and said, I accuse this man of mutiny. Well, it was real time. And Billy was so stunned that anybody would accuse him, because he loved Captain Deere, really loved Billy as a friend. And Captain Deere had no choice but to take a deposition. He said, well, Billy, obviously, he's rubbish, but what do you think yourself? And Billy didn't understand it, and he couldn't bring it out, and Private knew that. You're a mutiny. And he kept saying the thing about it. You know, mutiny, and Billy just got madder and madder, and the bones stood out, and there's no coming out of his ears. He says, Billy, I've got to hear from you. And the final allegory was like, pow! And he hit Private right in the head and dropped him like an ox and killed him. And Pierre looked down at him. How could I do? First you accuse of mutiny, now you've killed my officers. You're going to wonder where this guy's lesson was leading. And now I'm Melville from Britain. So they throw, it's not leading any good, but they throw Clyde a series of Billy insurance. It's got to be insurance. So the word goes on the ship, you just throw Clyde. Of course, everybody loves him because they hate his private stuff anyway, but you just can't go after him in wartime. Leads to mutiny. So they throw Billy in. The whole point of the story, I guess, is that they finally send Billy's going to be home. They send him in the padre, the preacher, to throw just some glass and stuff. And they're going to send for you, and it's still like there isn't that thing. He comes out and says, did he make it to be the God? And he says, he's already. He said, let him know he was born. And the parson came out completely at ease. And Billy's the one doing it. So I told you that guy, Jason, it's an interesting story. So here we have Walt Whitman on his way. We're down to about section 40 or 42, and he's only 53 sections. He's lying along with his catalog and the things he sees. There's some great lines in here. I don't have my copy, and I left mine back at PLC, and I forgot. He talks about being satisfied with things. He says, talk about the fear, and he says something about, don't look down upon the turtle because he's not a deer, or because he's not something else. Like, the turtle is beautiful. The deer is beautiful. Obviously, the turtle is beautiful. Don't wish to do something else or look down upon the turtle because he's not something else. Great philosophy. If you have any questions or comments as you go on, here's question 44. I'm bringing this to a close. Now he's going to tell us what he means. But it's time to explain myself. Let us stand up. What is known, I skip away. I launch all men and women forward with me into the unknown. The clock indicates the moment, but what does eternity indicate? We have thus far exhausted trillions of winters and summers. There are trillions ahead and trillions ahead of them. Births have brought us richness and variety, and other births have brought us richness and variety. I do not call one greater than and one smaller. That which fills its period and place is equal to any. Were mankind murderous or jealous upon you, my brother, my sister, I am sorry for you. They are not murderous or jealous upon me. All have been gentle with me. I keep no account with lamentation. What have I to do with lamentation? That's not true either. The life, as I pointed out in the beginning, he couldn't hold it. He was fired all the time about all kinds of jobs. People made fun of him. He was in hot water in politics. He finally just gave up and went down into the South and had some interesting adventures down there. Saw Abraham Lincoln became, of course, his great hero. And we have historical evidence that Lincoln saw Whitman one time. And only one line we have in scholarship years that man. What Lincoln said. You can make of that whatever you want. But Whitman would go into the field hospital during the war and help the surgeons. They would saw limbs and amputees. He would pick them up and throw them in a ditch. Nobody else would. He did that. He was doing a field hospital, he read the Bible to the patients, take the patient, right home with his sweethearts and parents. And he had a lot of traumatic things happen to him down there. And maybe that's one of the reasons he came back and started writing a new way. He was a new kind of a person, one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes, yeah, one of his poems, Out of the Cradle Under the Rocking, he talked about that out of the 12th month something, the musical shuttle. He would refer to months as 12th month or 7th month, and there's some indications of that. I might mention, if you haven't read Whitman for a while, that you can look at Song and Myself, but a couple others you ought to look at When Lilacs Last in the Cherry All Bloomed. Whitman's title is so good, he's giving up the writing of it. He's got Gillan Thomas, great title. When Lilacs Last in the Cherry All Bloomed, that's the title. It's about the death of Lincoln, which is the greatest poem of it. If Song and Myself is the epic, then Lilacs is the greatest lyric poem.
Yeah. Is he like Colin Blanc?
No, that was during Colin Blanc. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I'm making my talk about Colin. That's a great poem.
Yeah.
I was so stunned when I read that poem, and then I read the little asterisk footnote they wrote it in 17. I wanted to sit in my ears, so I didn't want to write it. It's like Mozart composing in the script. Who needs that? Right? Yeah. It's the closest to the page. But you notice he didn't tell us what it was. He's trying to stand up and trying to explain myself, but he didn't get around to it. Ah, I know I have the best of time and space and was never measured and never will be measured. I tramp a perpetual journey. Come listen, all. There's the invitation. Now we're going to get the stage thing. My signs are a rain-proof coat, big shoes, and a staff cut in the woods. No friend of mine takes his ease in my chair. I have no chair, no church, no philosophy. I leave no man to a dinner table, library, stock exchange. But each man and each woman of you I lead upon a knoll, my left hand hooking you around the waist, my right hand pointing to landscapes, the continents, and the public roads. Not I, nor anyone else, can travel that road for you. You must travel it for yourself. It is not far, it is within reach. Perhaps you have been on it since you were born and did not know. Okay. We're going to the end here. I've said that the soul is not more than the body, and I've said that the body is not more than the soul, and nothing, not God, is greater to one than oneself is. And whoever walks a furlong without sympathy walks to his own funeral dressed in the sky. Now he's getting into some new kind of stuff. And nothing, not God, is greater to one than oneself is. That's what Emerson. When Emerson says, nothing is at last sacred but the integrity of your own mind. That's the kind of thing that, among other things, that caused Emerson to step down from his pulpit, as you might imagine. I suppose there's some things that one is better off not doing from a pulpit. And that's probably one of them. But Emerson's a great, great mind. Okay, this is the last section. I'll close on this. The spotted hawk swoops by and accuses me. He complains of my gab and my loitering. I, too, am not a bit trained. I, too, am untranslatable. I found my barbaric yacht over the reach of the world. So he knew he was speaking in a new way. He was no dummy. He was a very well-read man. And he knew that this pre-verse business and this great cataloging was going to sound like barbaric yacht to a lot of people. And he says, I found it over the reach of the world. A little looper there. Jim Goley or sound barbaric way, whatever. The last set of day holds back to me. It flings my likeness after the rest and sea of any on the shadows wild. It coaxes me the vapor and the dust. I depart as air. I shake my white locks at the runaway sun. I effuse my flesh and eddies and drifted in lacy jazz. Now these last 8 lines. I bequeath myself to the birds to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look to me under your feet there. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean. But I should be good health to you, nevertheless. I'm filthy and fighty with death. Failing to fetch me at first, keep in place. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere, waiting for you.